afternoon, everyone. How are you? Thanks for coming. I'm so glad to see so many people here. Welcome to this temporary autonomous zone, which is how Hakim Bey described higher utopias. And thanks for everyone for coming to this special summertime talk co-sponsored by Stanford University Libraries and Stanford Law School's Center for Internet and Society. I hope this will grow into more of a larger discussion about the future of copyright and copyright in the digital era specifically. I'm James Jacobs. I'm the International Documents Librarian at Stanford Library. And we've invited Rick Falkwinje, the founder of the Swedish Pirate Party, to talk about copyright regime versus civil liberties. I'll let Carl Fogel, the organizer behind the site, questioncopyright.org, and Rick's foreign secretary of sorts, give a more formal introduction. But before that, I'd like to thank a few people for facilitating this talk. Thanks should be heaped on Mimi Calter, the executive assistant to the university librarian, and Jerry Persons, the chief information architect of Stanford University Libraries, as well as Lauren Gelman, Jennifer Granick, Deepti Rajendran, and no doubt others too from the Center for Internet and Society for co-sponsoring and hosting Rick's talk today, providing this really great room and the afternoon snacks, as well as the audio recording. And as you notice, we have some video recording. We have some pirate video artists here too. The audio will be on Stanford iTunes in short order. And I assume that the video will be out on the general internet as well. Thanks also to Carl Fogel for organizing Rick's trip. And most of all, thanks to Rick for coming all this way to talk to us about pirates, global copyright law, and civil liberties. And Carl?
I join James in thanking all the aforementioned people, except for myself. That would lead to an infinite loop, and we don't want that. I'm the editor of questioncopyright.org, and when we called Rick and asked, what seems like our organizations are sort of allied, would you like to come to America and speak, we expected to have to twist his arm. There are not a lot of Swedish voters in the Bay Area, and after all, he's running for parliament in Europe, not here. It turned out that he agreed immediately. And the reason is that the Pirate Party understands that their mission is not limited to Sweden. They are trying to spark a revolution in official policy on copyright and patents around the world. And as Rick will tell you shortly, nothing concentrates the minds of politicians as much as an electoral victory by an upstart party in a neighboring country. So what the pirates are doing in Sweden is going to affect Europe, and what happens in Europe is going to affect America eventually. Which brings me to my next point. Rick gave a very compressed version of this as a keynote speech at OSCON, the O'Reilly Open Source Convention, last week. After his keynote, people literally came up to the stage and pressed campaign donations into his hands. Political donations in Sweden are not regulated, and anonymity is the default for all donations to the Pirate Party. So you are all welcome to donate, and Rick will be giving you details on how. I encourage you to do so. I did so myself this morning. It was very easy over the internet. However, for this audience, I would also like to say, I know a lot of you are broke grad students, and donating to the Pirate Party just wasn't in the budget for this semester. But a lot of you are going to go out into the law and into public policy and even into politics. I hope that you will take with you the message that Rick brings. Copyrights and patents are doing great and yet in some ways invisible harm to our society. The damage is not limited to Sweden. And you're the people who have the power to do something about that. So without further ado, Rick Falkfinger.
Thank you, Carl. I have a mic. Thank you. So thank you all for having me here today. I'm very happy to be at Stanford. Before I start, I'm kind of curious. How many of people in here in the audience have heard of the Pirate Party before? Show of hands. Okay, so some. That's good. And for those of you who haven't, basically a brief explanation of who the clown is down in the pit who calls himself a pirate, is that in January of 2006, I set up a web page for a prototype new political party advocating copyright and patent reform and strengthening of privacy. It basically blew up in my face. Turned out there was a huge built-up demand. We very quickly became a real political party. In June of last year, we broke through to mainstream awareness through media. In September of last year, we had our first elections. We got 0.63% of the popular vote. I wasn't too happy with that at the time, but it turned out that that made us finish in the top 10, which I'm a lot more happy about. And actually turns out to be a record for a party founded on election year. We're particularly strong among first-time voters and the young voters, which can be seen in our youth section, which is now ranked number 4 among the youth sections, and which has grown by 30% in the past 6 months alone. So, what causes all of this commotion? What causes all of this emotion? And what causes people to vote for a party that may not even get representation in parliament? Well, if you look at the file-sharing debate, it tends to focus on economic principles. It tends to focus on, does file-sharing hurt profits of the distributors? And it goes downhill from there. It becomes a yes, it does, no, it doesn't, yes, it does, no, it doesn't, yes, it does. You get a lot of conflicting reports saying, having lots of intricate, complicated, multisyllable words and arriving at completely different conclusions. It becomes just a trench warfare discussion with people throwing stuff at each other. And at that point, the audience kind of loses interest in the whole debate. So what we did was to just completely ignore the economic aspects and go back to the roots of copyright, saying that it is a commercial monopoly. At its creation, books were distributed to bookstores by horse and cart. So if you found an infraction of copyrights in those days, you could either find it in a bookstore, you could find a copied book, you could find a concert that was given without permission or giving license money, and the key here is that you found those in public places with the naked eye. Today, however, copyright has crept into my private communication. It is illegal for me to send music in a piece of email to you guys. If we were on the same chat channel, it would be illegal for me to drop a video clip there. And so in order to enforce copyright in the digital age, every piece of private communication must all of a sudden be monitored by law enforcement and by corporate interest groups. Every one and zero that leaves my computer may potentially be infringing copyright, so every one and zero must be analyzed, and that includes the ones and zeros that happen to be letters to my lawyer or doctor. Out goes the postal secret, which is generally regarded as a foundation of our democracy. The copyright industry is also lobbying for internet service providers to be liable for what their users do on the net. This touches upon another principle, which is called the common carrier principle, another age-old foundation, which means that the messenger is never responsible for the contents of the message. Imagine if the U.S. Postal Service would start having an opinion on what you write in your letters, or if your phone company would call you after you just had hung up the hook and say that, sir, you used obscene language in this phone call. That is not acceptable, and your phone connection will be cut if you do it again. This is what the copyright industry is lobbying for when it comes to internet connections. So, old lady justice has a problem. On one side of the scale is one income source for one entertainment industry, essentially a luxury consumption. On the other side of the scale are two basic foundations of our democracy. Tricky. And there's more to it. If you accept that private communications need to be monitored, out goes whistleblower protection. If there's somebody monitoring what I write in email, regardless of what they may or may not do with that information, if I were to uncover a scandal and mail a reporter about it, that mail will have been read by somebody, and if it's juicy enough, that person will remember that next time they go to the bar and get all drunk and talk about it with their friends. It's been read, it cannot be unread, and the protection is gone. And by extension, what are you going to use the freedom of the press for? If you don't have any reliable sources inside government who can be protected when they report that something is amiss or afoot, what are you going to print? This week's horoscope? And I'm going to extend it a bit further still. If you know that you're monitored, you tend to put a little bit of self-restraint on yourself, on what you say. You tend to not say what you would have said when you know that you're in private with friends. And this was sort of a theoretical argument for me, just sort of logical, rational reasoning, being the extreme left-hand side brain that I am, until I visited the Gay Pride Parade in Stockholm. Beside the Pride Parade is something called the Pride Park, where most parties actually can be found and have representation, and there were we as well. And I tried this argument that if you don't have access to private communication, you lose the right to form an identity, because your identity is formed as a result of a very private exchange between you and a couple of friends you trust. Again, this was a totally rational argument, but the thing that struck me was that argument hit this crowd very hard and very emotionally. You could see the penny drop. You could see them relive the pain they experienced as they went through this process. Privacy is very important to some people that we don't really think about, in ways we don't really think about it. And as a side note, we got, in a very unofficial poll later in Pride Park, we got 20%, so they really do understand why privacy is good. So I don't care about whether file sharing reduces profits for a certain luxury industry. This is what the conflict is about. It is about vital civil liberties that are a foundation of our democracy that need to be eroded or, in worst case, abolished in order to maintain crumbling monopolies. That's how bad it is. And I'm going to give you a little bit of history. Once, at the dawn of the universe, when space was vast, uninhabited, and mostly tax-free, there was the Recording Industry Association of America. No, I'm going to back up a little bit and go to the Catholic Church that basically had a monopoly on culture and knowledge in the millennium before last, as in around year 900. Whatever the church said was the truth. And the funny thing here is that if you can control somebody's culture and knowledge, you have no need in the world to have laws made for you, because you already control the world. And this communication was totally top-down. It had one source, too many, to the many. Fast forward a bit to the printing press, late 1400s. All of a sudden, there were many sources. There was still a top-down communication. There was still a one-to-many communication, as I like to say because I'm a tech geek. And people could pick and choose which sources they wanted to listen to. This was immensely unpopular with the ones that had been the sole previous source. So the Royal High Society did not like this at all. There was a lot of subversive pamphlets printed. There was a lot of immoral culture and knowledge printed. So the Royal Houses took two steps. First of all, they added the idea of a responsible publisher, that the publisher, the source of any culture and information, could always be held civilly and criminally responsible for whatever culture and knowledge gets out to the citizens. So you're free to publish whatever you want, but if you should publish the wrong piece of culture and knowledge, bad things will happen. And the British court actually went even further. In the mid-1500s, 1554, they created a company called London Company of Stationers, which were granted a monopoly on printing books, or actually on printing period. They were also given the authority to burn anything not printed by them. So they became a private police force with the role of acting as censors on behalf of the British Crown. This lasted for about a century. And at the end of the 1600s, the British Parliament sort of backed down and said that, you know, stationers, we've sort of thought about this for generations, and we don't really like this idea about having a censoring monopoly anymore. We think that we should go back to the way it was, with a free jungle for everybody to print whatever they want. Freedom of the press is a good thing. And, of course, the old monopoly panicked. They did not want to they did not at all want to let go of this privilege of having a monopoly of printing every piece of cultural knowledge in Britain. So what happened was that they sort of thought about this a lot. And since they had been a private police force burning books and being a censorship on behalf of the British Crown for over a century, with all the immense popularity that came with this task, they didn't have a whole lot of credibility. So what they did was actually quite ingenious. They went to Parliament and argued that authors should own their work. It should become a form of property. And this is the first time I've found in history where property has been used in this context. They should be given a monopoly to decide whoever gets to print, or actually they should be given a monopoly on printing their books and reselling them. And since this is a property, the printers reasoned in front of Parliament, then that property must reasonably be able to be bought and sold, like any other property. So what happened was that you had a distribution chain, a media distribution chain, that was about to lose a monopoly power and went before Parliament and argued on behalf of the authors that the authors should have this monopoly because they knew the authors would need to sell it to them. So that's essentially how, and that was the first law that we today call copyright. It was signed into law in 1709 and took effect in 1710. Well, so while this law has a lot of wording about being for the benefits of authors, today usually written as creative artists or stuff like that, it was never for the artists. From the very first letter of the law of copyright is what it was for the distributors. And this is important to remember, because even today, the distributors are going to Congress and claiming to represent artists and arguing for an extension of their monopolies. Things have not changed in 300 years. Today, however, the media situation is completely different. I like to think of it as a nice bowl of spaghetti with a little bit of pesto on top. No, seriously. This is supposed to be this is my visualization of how communication today works as opposed to the top-down model. You have a completely organic flow of culture and knowledge. Millions of people are connected at the same time. There's no organization. There are no structures. There is no control of who tells whom what anymore. And this makes a huge difference. There's no longer anybody to hold accountable if the wrong piece of culture or knowledge should slip out into the public. You could always look for leaks, but when everybody is a source, it's sort of pointless to talk about a top-down model. And the distributors have become, on the whole, unnecessary. I do not need a record company to talk to an artist, to print records, to ship pieces of plastic on trucks across the country for me to sell in stores when I can get that stuff directly from the artist. And this actually makes a huge difference. We're seeing a huge shift in power over culture and knowledge that is as large as when the Catholic Church lost its power about 500 years ago. So what we want to do, our vision of what we want to do is, we want to return copyright to cover commercial use. Copyright has nothing to do in my private mail. Sorry, the buck stops there. I'm fine with having a time-limited commercial monopoly on certain creative types of works, or actually on all creative works, because there are some works that would not have been created if you couldn't guarantee a return on investment. For example, like multi-zillion dollar movies out of Hollywood. However, we also want to encourage, and not just allow, but explicitly encourage, all non-commercial collection, use, derivation, and spread of culture and knowledge. And our vision of the near future is one where every human being, or at least every human being with a connection to the internet, has continuous access to the collective sum of all human knowledge and culture. This is possible with today's technology. It's just a few old crumbling monopolies standing in the way of this vision. And this is a huge leap ahead for humanity. It is much larger than when public libraries arrived about 150 years ago. Which in itself was a huge leap ahead. So, I'm talking a lot about monopolies here. Technology has always changed business models. A century ago, the largest employer in my hometown, Stockholm, the capital of Sweden, was called Stockholm Ice. Its business was to cut up ice in winter, store it in huge barns, and cut it up during the rest of the year and ship it out to households so that they could store food for longer. This company is not around anymore. So it's not too far-fetched to say that technology probably always will change business models, make some obsolete, and create new ones. So I'm saying that just as a few examples of what this vision might enable in terms of new businesses. And just to frame this, I'm saying that commercial use must be explicitly encouraged. Sorry, non-commercial use must be explicitly encouraged. That doesn't mean you can't commercially facilitate that. Like, if I were to date somebody in this audience, that would be completely non-commercial, even if we both had subscribed to a commercial dating service. The date itself would still be non-commercial, as opposed to if I had, say, bought a date from somebody with associated activities, which might not have been legal. So this is just a few of the business methods or business models that would work perfectly in this kind of world. And these are just four I thought of off the top of my head. And I mean, I'm at Stanford. I'm not going to tell you what to do. You're the geniuses here. And the real problem is really that the politicians do not understand this. They're too preoccupied with their healthcare, with their energy policy, with their defense, with their unemployment, with their tax policy. Heck, they just woke up to something called the environment. It was introduced 30 years ago. The copyright industry, on the other hand, understands this perfectly. They look clueless. They are very good at looking clueless. However, when you look at what they lobby for, it becomes clear that they understand exactly what is required to maintain their crumbling monopolies. They understand exactly the sacrifices that are needed, and they are lobbying for exactly those. And I'm going to give you two examples. First, the copyright industry was lobbying for a bill in Brussels recently. Brussels is the European equivalent of Washington, D.C. That would give 4 years of prison to anybody passively accepting file sharing. And those 4 years is a magical limit that would have given the copyright industry basically unlimited access to warrantless wiretapping in most states of Europe. There goes the postal secret. I was at a Copyright Insiders seminar in Stockholm recently on May 29. They actually sent out an open invitation, so a lot of pirates dressed up in suit and tie and attended. Like my vice chairman says, if you can't convince them, at least confuse them. And the Danish head honcho of their anti-piracy group held a speech where he said that, you know, politicians don't understand file sharing. We're in perfect agreement so far. So what we need to do is to filter the internet, he said. And in order to do that, we must associate file sharing with child pornography. Because politicians understand child pornography. This is how cynical and unscrupulous these people are. It might come as a coincidence that about a month later, the Pirate Bay was threatened with filtering by the Swedish police force over allegations that never materialized over just child porn. It might be a coincidence, but as Douglas Adams said, coincidences are dangerous things. So our solution was to bypass the politicians. Head straight for the voters. Challenge the old politicians on election day at the polls. And frankly, I think we did pretty well. Summarizing our platform, we're saying, like I said, that file sharing must be allowed because the alternative is to abolish a lot of civil liberties. Sampling is good. That's the creation of a whole new set of culture. The commercial copyright time, we don't think it's reasonable that it's lifetime plus 70 years. From my personal perspective, that means infinity, because any work created now will not be released into the public domain while I live. And there's no investor that makes investment on the off chance that a movie might become popular 125 years in the future. Rather, they're calculating an opening weekend. So we're suggesting 5 years from publication. That's just a stake in the ground. It might be three, it might be 10. We're just saying that it needs to be shortened and drastically. Attribution, we like attribution a lot. It's the key for many, many artists to create it all, to get their name out there. We think DRM is evil. That's essentially corporations writing their own copyright laws and arbitrarily enforcing them. We have parliament to write such laws. Thank you very much. We don't like patents at all. We think they range from totally useless to immoral to evil. We like privacy a lot. We like due process even more, and think that a transparent government is even better. And this is practically the whole of our platform. We do not take a stance on things where we don't have anything useful to add to the debate. We don't take a stance on energy policy. We don't take a stance on whether the unemployment benefit should be 78 or 80%. And I'm coming to that in a minute, why we are. But one of the important things about our platform is that no single business model relying on copyright would break because of these suggestions. The things that make money today would make money tomorrow. The only difference is that millions of people would not be criminal. Patents, however, might go out of business, especially those that just hoard patents without producing anything themselves. So what we've done is that we've influenced other parties. What happened was that after the elections, parties in Sweden kind of came to us and asked that, you know, guys, we don't really understand these issues. If we buy you lunch, would you mind explaining them to us? Of course we want to. That's what we wanted the whole time. Now you tell us. If you told us 18 months ago, we wouldn't have to gone through all this trouble. So we've talked to the parties in Sweden about these issues. We have talked to a lot of the youth sections that totally understand these issues. They are, we sometimes joke that we don't have one youth section, we have eight. The others are all on our side. And the most extreme example is actually the Norwegian Liberal Party that copied our entire stance on copyright and adopted it unanimously as their own. That was the best sign for me so far that we are not out in the fringes. We are just very much ahead of the bell curve. We built an organization. On election day, we had 2,000 volunteers covering 93% of the polling stations nationwide. I was extremely happy with that number. We built that in eight months. And we had a record first election. And to give you a couple of more numbers there, my personal candidacy came in at rank 15 out of over 5,700 candidates for parliament. Now, I didn't win a seat because the party didn't get enough votes. We didn't pass the threshold. But it tells you something about how strongly people feel about these issues. In another number, there are also school mock elections held in Sweden in parallel with the real election. And we got 4.5% in that election. And we weren't actually on the ballot, so those were all write-in votes. So coming back to why we have a narrow platform, how can a 4% party make a difference? How could you contain your laughter if you're in a if you're in a parliament with 349 seats and 16 people down in the corner are sitting there with pirate's hats and going, har, 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 har? Well, the thing is, in Sweden, there are two party blocks, the socialist and the bourgeois. And they're always very, very, very tied in elections. 1% here or there determines who gets to rule for the next 4 years. So the reason we are aiming for 4% is that both blocks would need our support in order to form a majority government. That means that given 4%, we get to sit down and play who wants to be a prime minister. And the bloc that agrees the most or gives us the best deal on intellectual property reform, on strengthening our privacy, due process, and a transparent government, we'll vote with them on everything else. So having a narrow platform is not a weakness in this case. It is a strength that allows us to play this leverage. This is a particular feature of a parliament with proportional representation. And why Sweden then? Well, the numbers you see up on screen here are numbers of global production. The yearly global production is $60 trillion. $12 trillion come from the US. Equally much comes from Europe. Only differs by a fraction of a percent and varies daily based on currency rates. 10 comes from China. What this means is that the U.S. copyright lobby cannot get the Department of Trade, I think that's what it's called, to threaten trade sanctions against Europe because it's as strong. As opposed to if there had been a pirate party in, say, Burkina Faso, which is not as economically strong. And also, the copyright laws are actually at the state level in Europe, whereas in the US they're at the federal level, as you all know. That means that Sweden is at liberty to change its copyright laws, while all the time enjoying this great shield from trade sanctions. So I'm going to argue that the best way to get an intellectual property reform in the US is actually to take the scenic route through Europe and set up a chain of events that'll more or less change this globally. So we have two elections coming up. The first is the European election in 2009, followed by the national election in 2010. And to give you a few numbers there, we had 35,000 votes in the national election of 2006. We had another 35,000 in the school election, who will come voting age in this election in 2009. That gives us 70,000 votes. We need 100,000 votes to put people into the European Parliament. We need to grow by 50%, counting from September of 2006, in order to put people into the European Parliament. And remember now, our youth section has grown by 30% in the last 6 months alone. The numbers really suggest that we can do this. We can actually pull this off. So, elections brings me to election campaigns. Sort of brings me to election campaign funding. If you know somebody that might be interested in contributing, I know you're all students, and I perfectly remember what it was like to be a student. If you know somebody that might be interested in contributing, then campaign contributions in Sweden are not regulated. We treat all contributions as anonymous. That means we will not confirm nor deny anybody who claims to contribute. There is a folder, looks like this. It's at the table by the door that contains a summary of this keynote as well as more information on why we're aiming for $10 million for both campaigns and a URL. Oh, right, this is called the Contributors Brief. And a URL, which is this, www.piratpartiet, which is Pirate Party in Swedish, .se/donate. It contains this brochure as well, and more information about how you can contribute if you want, or know somebody that might. And that's all. Let's go change the world.
Is this mic on? Yeah. So now we'll have a few minutes of question and answer, and I'll ask everybody, if you have a question, raise your hand, and I'll bring this mic over to you because we are audio recording. And so we'll open it up to the floor. Thanks once again, Rick. That was great.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Are there any questions from the floor? Yeah.
You've proposed that there be some copyright term, say 5 or 10 years, and you've also proposed that everybody should have complete access to the sum of our knowledge and culture. So how do you reconcile those in a way that allows copyright owners to make effective use of their copyright to make money?
So what I'm saying is about copyright is essentially two things. A, it needs to be reduced in scope. It cannot intrude on vital civil liberties. And two, it needs to be reduced in length. There is no investor that bases a return on investment calculation on, well, 10 years is stretching it. So what I'm going to claim is that anything that makes money today is going to make money tomorrow, because people already have access through extra legal means to all of humanity's knowledge and culture. The difference is that they wouldn't be criminal. I mean, just to pick one example, theaters today don't any longer sell you watching the movie. They sell you watching the movie in a theater. They may not admit this, but it's how reality have come to be. If you want to see the movie, you can do so in the privacy at your home, even if the movie industry likes you doing so or not. Did that answer the question?
A little bit. It sounds like copyright owners' profits would be drastically reduced under your regime. No question, because a lot of the consumers of copyrighted material are individuals who, if they had access to the work anyway, would share it, unless it were, say, embargoed from the repository of culture for the copyright term.
I'm going to say that, yes, in a sense, but only because copyright owners today are distributors, and distributors have become by and large unnecessary with today's largely increased and enhanced flow of information. The original creators, however, not being dependent on distributors anymore, can find alternate streams of revenue. For example, musicians frequently make a lot of their money through concerts, and if that's their revenue stream, then just spreading their music around will become a market driver for their primary revenue stream. Of course, at the loss of distributors, but like I argued, technology has always changed which business models are available.
I'm actually To clarify, you're actually suggesting that anything that could be distributed digitally or effectively would remove physical distribution and then wouldn't be able to get any financial financial compensation for it. But other means could be used to get financial compensation for those.
Yes, I am saying that the copyright monopoly must not regulate anything that I send in communication, anything that is covered by the postal secret, anything that is covered by telecommunications.
Okay.
And, I mean, looking back, this didn't start now. It started when Xerox copiers came along in the 60s. You could take a poem, photocopy it, and send it in a letter to a friend. That was the same kind of copyright infringement that we see on a large scale today.
So one of the sources of a lot of the standards for copyright law in an awful lot of countries is the Berne Convention.
Mm-hmm.
Are you advocating that Sweden drop out of the Berne Convention? What's your position there?
No, we can't easily do that because the Berne Convention is a good question. Thank you. The Berne Convention is part of our agreement with the European Union. So that's why I'm saying, first and foremost, copyright needs to be limited in scope, and we also believe that it needs to be limited in term. And the limitation in scope, we can do. Sweden already has an exception in copyright law that allows private individuals to send computer programs between one another, on the very justification that anything else would threaten postal secret. Therefore, and since we are also part of an agreement that says that books, film, music, and computer programs should all have the same protection, it becomes a trivial effort to justify that this particular exception should be extended to all kinds of creative works.
I think about this a lot, and let me pick an example and see if I can try to get your message. Regardless of the merit, you can argue that. Let's take, for instance, the new Simpsons movie, and let's mm-hmm. take the new Harry Potter book. And you were talking about the fact that you don't want to have all the internet monitored. If the Simpsons movie gets made and the very first day, mm-hmm. that gets distributed all over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
People want to watch it in their homes,
mm-hmm.
on their computer screens, or if the book gets distributed the same way,
mm-hmm.
You can still sell it in the movie theater if that's what you're selling, seeing it at the movie theater. But how will this change the landscape if somebody can no longer protect an investment of 50, 100, 150 million for a movie, or a long time plus a lot of printing of books. How will that change the landscape as to what people will be willing to go invest their time in to create?
Okay, so I have three answers to that question. First, the landscape has already changed. What we want to do is change the map to match the landscape. Second, the theaters today are not anymore selling seeing the movie. They're selling seeing the movie in a theater. The Simpsons movie is already out. The Harry Potter book is already out. Nobody in their right frame of mind who wants to see these movies wants to see or read them on a computer screen because the quality is frankly lousy. You might want to use it as a consumer tool to test out new products, to get a glimpse of new products. And if the movie is good, you go to see it and get the full experience. And my third response is that even if these investments would not be made unless the copyright gets to intrude on my private communication, then sorry, those investments will not be made because I will not allow that.
So, I mean, it's a very novel point, and it's a very interesting convention that you're addressing. And a quick note is, like, the Simpsons movie, like, the Pirate Bay, it has their new updated logo with the Simpsons by the crew. But I have a question. If you look at the landscape of media today, you see the consumers going towards this trend of on-demand internet access. They don't want to watch a movie based on the theater's times, or they like the TiVo convention. So I pose the question to you, how exactly do you address a copyright owner who's creating a film or a show with a multi-million dollar budget and is trying to create a profit but is trying to break out of the theater model or and address a consumer that wants their content on demand?
Well, I mean, look at the Spider-Man movie. Look at pretty much any blockbuster. They make their investment back not in 1 year, not in 2 years, but on opening weekend. And that's sort of when the first leak comes out. And so the first leak might hit the file sharing networks on Monday or Tuesday, and the investments has already been covered. All the rest is profit. That's my point. What makes a profit today will make a profit tomorrow. I'm not sure that answered your question.
Well, the point I was trying to say is, for example, if you're saying to change the landscape, right? And the current convention is that you make the bulk of your profit on opening weekend. Say you get rid of that model. Say you get rid of the theater, or you get rid of that experience of selling the movie in the theater context. Where would you make that money?
Okay, so what you're asking me for now is a new business model, and
not necessarily so much as a business model as the envisionment of the landscape you're talking about. Where the consumer, where all content is distributed digitally, and the only thing you pay for, I guess, is the right to see it somewhere?
Okay, so I'm not going to invent business models. What I can see is that I see a few trends. And one of those very clear trends is that you move from culture as a pre-packaged commodity to culture as a service, either as a performance art, Or like I said, as in seeing it in a theater, or World of Warcraft, for that matter. It is a service which you subscribe to, which lets you be part of this whole fantasy world. And besides, when it comes to business models, I see a lot of new business models being enabled by these changes, like I drafted a bit about earlier.
You were saying for movies that most of the movies make their profit in the first opening weekend, but how would you address the issue about profits for companies who make software and games?
Oh, games is a particularly easy one, because games have been around for as long as there have been file sharing and piracy, and that particular industry has seen record growth year after year, despite the fact that there is tons and tons of piracy around. So I'm not particularly worried about that particular industry. Software, well, to be honest, I think the software industry has been helped tremendously by piracy, because it facilitates adoption. There are rumors, and I believe there is some merit to them, that Microsoft does not tackle piracy problem in a country before it reaches a certain point, before saturation of their products reaches a certain point of the population, at which point they know they'll have a market stranglehold and can start enforcing getting profits out of it.
Hi. You didn't really go into your platform on the point about patents. I was sort of curious as to how, sort of similar to the corporate commercial copyright, how you would make your money without some sort of protection in terms of like technological advances or whatever, how you would expect to, protect
right.
that.
Right. So this was my talk on copyright. My talk on patents is equally as long and about half as much again. So I'm not going to give you all of it. I'm just going to shorten it down to the fact that we've looked at every claim benefit of patents and found them all to be false. And the most notorious claim benefit is that of the the myth of the inventor genius. That this lone guy sits in his basement, can't afford lightning, and basically comes up with something fantastic that'll revolutionize the world and make him a happy, happy zillionaire. And, well, you know the story. And this is a quite beautiful myth, but unfortunately it is just that. It is a myth. Even the Swedish chief of the patent office wrote in an editorial a week ago that patents do not protect inventors from corporate predatory aggression, which is pretty much their only basic function. Of course, our conclusions were completely different. He asked for more money. We think he should be fired and his office closed. So that's the short of it. Why would you invent? Well, you invent stuff because you can sell it. Nokia invents new features of mobile phones because they sell mobile phones. The patents that come through on those mobile phones come through when the models are already obsolete. So your first-to-market advantage is much more important from a market perspective and from a business perspective than the ability to patent stuff.
Hello.
Hi.
Have you thought much about collective licensing paradigms, and if so, do you have a position on it?
Collective licensing, as in terms of radio and in terms of the commercial parts of copyright, we have not addressed that in terms of that it works pretty well today. There are some things that we think that, okay, this is probably not optimal, but we need to address one problem at a time. So at my last talk, which was at Google, there was a musician that stood up and said that he's a musician and he also runs a small web radio. And because SoundExchange has a monopoly on collecting licenses in the U.S., he's forced to pay SoundExchange for playing his own music in his own radio channel, which is just mind-boggling, frankly. But we haven't addressed the problem. I'm probably sure we will get around to doing it once we've changed the rest of the world.
I have another question related to, so you said attribution is very important.
Yes.
How does that
fit
into copying other people's works, modified, and how does that relate to trademark?
Trademark. Let me take that first, because I think it's quite important why I do not bring up trademarks. We looked at all the different aspects of intellectual property, which are frankly quite different animals, and I'm not entirely sure why they've been clumped together under the umbrella intellectual property. So copyrights and patents benefit only the monopoly holder, whereas a trademark is at its heart a consumer protection against fraud on a market where the seller and buyer are not personally acquainted. It is a fraud protection, and it also reduces transaction costs. So you might want to argue that if I made a video that had the Sony name on it and sold it to you, what would that make? Well, it would make trademark infringement, but it would also constitute fraud because obviously I am not Sony. So, is trademark really necessary when every infringement is practically already fraud? It might not be. What we found was that the harm done by trademarks were practically nothing. So, we tried instead to focus on the things that we thought did the most harm, which are, in our view of the world, copyrights and patents. And you had another question. Sorry, what was the first half?
Attribution.
We think that attribution is important. So what was it about?
How does that relate to trademark and
Right, right. How does attribution relate to...
And how does it relate to copying and modifications of original works?
Modification. Thank you. How does attribution relate to modification? Let me give you an example. When there was a... in the 50s and 60s, a lot of classical works were remade into rock music. And they were still given attribution as the original work. And that's pretty much how I think it should be. Even though they said that this has been remade by these guys.
So you advocate just continuous, like, attribution, of, like a modification of a modification would have that chain of modifiers, and then you have another modifier to have that chain.
Well, there become... So the question was, do I advocate having infinite chains of attribution across every step along the way of the evolution of culture from, well, basically, hill paintings? And obviously, there needs to be some reason to that. I mean, if I take a work and obviously modify it, then I think it's reasonable that I give attribution to the original creator. There is a line between taking a work and modifying and being inspired by somebody else that I'm not going to go into in detail, but you can feel emotionally that it is there somewhere.
I was just wondering if you had any particular policies or further thoughts about whistleblower protection. I note that there are sort of already kind of anonymous internet piracy approaches to the problem, mm-hmm. like WikiLeaks.org. Your thoughts on this sort of thing?
The Swedish whistleblower protection is actually very strong and written into the Constitution. It is called a messenger's protection, and it differs from the U.S. protection in that, whereas in the U.S., reporters have a right to keep their sources secret. In Sweden, if the source requests it, they have an obligation to keep their sources secret. So the protection becomes the source and not the reporter. And we're very happy with this and don't advocate any changes. We are upset, however, when other things jeopardize this protection.
Get my exercise to that.
I was just wondering what the Pirate Party saw this earlier this year when the Pirate Bay was shut down and the servers were seized. What kind of impact that had on the party news, or it seemed like at least here in the U.S. you guys got a lot of press, and I think a lot of
us kind of got awareness
of what you guys are doing just based on that event in itself. So just wondering if you could talk a little about that.
Didn't change our views a bit. Those were already had been debated and were pretty much mature at that point. What happened, though, was that we sent out press releases when this happened, and all of a sudden national media started calling, TV started calling. We were on the national news every hour, pretty much for a week. And that's when we had our real media breakthrough, and our membership count tripled in just a few days. So that's when everybody became aware that of the fact that there is a pirate party, and it's fighting for something. Most people may not understand exactly what it is, which I've been talking about here today. They do know that we are fighting for file sharing. Most people probably don't know exactly why and what is at stake. So it had a huge impact on our results and our uptake.
I read online that the Pirate Bay was trying to buy its own island or something like that, and I was just wondering if you're trying to make a statement by having the site up in the first place, then what's the point of moving to an island where you're not fighting any laws?
So, I need to clarify one thing here, and that is that there are three pirate organizations in Sweden, and we're completely separate. We're fighting for similar goals, but in completely different angles of attack. There's the Pirate Bay, who are bad boys with an attitude. There's the Pirate Bureau, which are a lobby organization, an NGO, and then there's us who are taking the parliamentary route. So I'm totally the wrong person to ask as to the Pirate Bay plans, because they are not us. I'm sorry.
Come on, you're killing them here.
Did you guys like plan this on taking turns?
James Ping Pong.
What is the situation in Sweden for independence of the parliament, the government, from moneyed interests? How are campaigns financed? How bribeable are officials? And
thank
so
you.
On?
A good question. Very good question with regards to our fundraising. Party funding is done through taxes. The problem is, if you're not in the system, you don't get a dime. Essentially, the seven parties in parliament have decided that they will get $10 million for every election campaign, and the parties outside of parliament won't get a dime because they are not in parliament and the others are. So that's why we're trying to raise $10 million to get into parliament. That would be kickstart capital, after which we would be in the system.
So have you had any issues for example, U.S. pharmaceuticals funding other parties in the Swedish political system in opposition to your platform to ban patents or to abolish
patents?
No,
they don't understand the issues. They are too preoccupied with the existing, like school, healthcare, energy policy, and so on. And I mean, that was our original problem, that politicians generally did not care for these issues. The penalty for making a bad decision was that somebody in backwaters nowhere might get upset a bit.
So you don't expect any opposition from the Swedish pharmaceutical industry?
Oh, we might get some opposition from them, but we have votes and they don't. So I don't think they fully realize the impact we're starting to have. And as for... No, sorry. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, I must confess, I had no idea that until today that you guys were attacking copyrights from the privacy end of things. And given that privacy and information rights, things like that, managing your personal information and who gets to see it and whatnot is a sort of a hot topic in the U.S. these days. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you guys are considering sort of strengthening your platform with additional privacy arguments and perhaps through that gaining some popularity in the U.S.?
Oh, we do have lots and lots of privacy. I mean, we're standing on three legs. Shared culture, free knowledge, and protected privacy. Those are our three core issues. So what this boils down to is essentially information ethics. What information is public versus what information is private? And how is private information kept private? We are very, very much in favor of safeguarding private information over and way beyond what is done today. It's one of the cores of our platform.
Thank you.
There's more information about this on our website, by the way, under international. You could read our full platform if you're trouble going to sleep someday.
All right. I won't claim to understand any European Parliament governments here, but I do have a question for you. Supposing that your party becomes so very powerful and gains so much support that it overthrows the power or equals the power of one of the main parties mm-hmm. that exist, mm-hmm. how comfortable will you be in taking, of course, how comfortable would you be in taking on a broad platform and becoming a very mainstream party? Or would you simply terminate your party because your goal had been met?
Neither. Actually, going back to this slide. Oh, no, here it works. There. If our slide here were, say, more than 50%, I mean, we've gone through all of these scenarios. If we'd be larger than the other two combined, that would still be a balance of power position. It would still be a tiebreaker position. It would only be an unusually strong one, But it was, the strategy would still work. And since we really don't seek a mandate from the voters on any other issues, then I don't think we should try to invent them once in Parliament.
Okay, so...
So I have a question about the privacy aspect of it. It's not very new that we have privacy invasions as a result of trying to enforce our laws, right? We have lawful access and wiretap and search warrants and all those sorts of things.
And I'm fine with that.
And so I'm wondering if you can kind of crystallize for me what the difference is between the nature of the privacy violations that are required by copyright enforcement as regard, you know, vis-a-vis the nature of privacy violations that are required by the enforcement of our other laws.
We're saying that wiretapping and privacy invasions of people under suspicion of a crime is perfectly okay. We're also saying that privacy invasion of everybody is equally not okay. We're perfectly fine with if somebody is under suspicion of a crime, that is fine to wiretap them. It is not okay to wiretap everybody to try to catch them in the act, which is essentially what it takes with copyright.
Well, we kind of have this issue now in the United States with the terrorist surveillance program and the government's program to capture all of our emails and phone calls and then filter through them and find out, you know, who the terrorists are. And I think that you'd find that there's a lot of sympathy in the United States, maybe not in this room and maybe not with me, but a lot of sympathy in the United States for this idea that, you know, the government should have access to everything that it can have access to when they're trying to fight terrorism. And I'm wondering if the Pirate Party's argument with that is fundamental. Like, we just don't believe that that should be true for any kind of criminal activity, no matter whether it's murder or terrorism or something serious, or whether it's less fundamental and more that we don't think that this level of privacy invasion is justified by this particular type of offense. This offense doesn't justify that kind of reaction.
Well, I guess that's what I said, that it's a good word question. I guess that's my weighing earlier that Lady Justice has a problem. On one side of the scale is one income source for the entertainment industry, and on the other side are these fundamentals of our democracy. If it were murder and not risking one income source of a luxury consumption, then obviously the scale would tip differently. So, first of all, should somebody under suspicion of murder, do I think they should be wired? Do I think that they should be allowed to be wiretapped? Yes, I do. Do I think that you should have wiretapping of everybody all the time, just in case they are plotting a crime? No, I don't, no matter how serious. There have been societies where crime fighting have taken precedence over privacy, where like crime fighting has been the ultimate priority and where it's been very efficient. I mean, if somebody challenges you and say that, well, shouldn't we have access to more efficient means to fight crime? And it becomes this question that you can't say no to, which is the first red flag to pop up in my mind. Of course you want more efficient crime fighting, right? Nobody would argue that we need more inefficient crime fighting. So it becomes a matter of priorities. And to give you a list of countries that have had very efficient combating of crime at expense of personal privacy, I'd list East Germany, Cuba, North Korea, East Berlin, and so on and so forth. And one asks oneself, is the society that these particular people arrived in the society we tried so hard to defend with these measures? At what point... No, I'm saying that there simply isn't a case where wiretapping everybody is justified. The societies that have had shrouded governments and transparent citizens generally have not been very nice places to live in. That's why I so adamantly advocate the opposite. That was a long answer, sorry. I'll step off my soapbox now. Okay.
Does your party have a position on artist subsidies or any other kind of government support of the arts? That seems like it might go in hand with less commercialization of the products that they're creating.
Support for artists? No, we don't. There is a lot of, as in subsidies for theaters, artists, musicians, and so on. We don't, because there are a lot of other parties that have positions on that already, and we feel that we don't have anything to add to the debate that has been introduced into society as a result of the digitization and the information society. What we are saying is that compact cassette blank media levies are unjustified because they go to the copyright industry. A garage band that buys blank tapes to record things in their garage need to pay the copyright industry in order to do that, and we don't think that's justified. That's the only position we take on those matters.
We'll take this last one and then...
Okay.
So I guess I'd like to sum up another question with the example you just mentioned, a garage band. Nowadays, it's become really popular or common for a garage band or any sort of upstarting artist to create some sort of revenue through online sales. Now, in your model, say, for example, you got rid of those blank media taxes, and they can't create a concert tour, or they don't have the means to go through the public performance method that you mentioned of alternate routes to revenue. How would you explain to that garage band the proper way to gain revenue or become a successful artist?
I would actually not ask me, but I would ask some of the artists in Sweden who have made a living practically much off of file sharing for the past several years, 10 years in the most extreme case. There are artists who do this. Some of them make a living through concerts. Others make a living through making their music available to film studios who then use it in commercial context and therefore pay license money. There are lots and lots of revenue streams that you can tap if you just step out of this box of selling your music prepackaged by the unit.
Okay. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Can I have a big hand for Rick again? Thank you.